So to introduce our brother Sam Mansfield's words of exhortation, read from Matthew 19 and from verse 13 to verse 30. And we now look forward to the words that our brother Sam Mansfield has prepared for us with the background there of a fantastic chapter. Brother Sam.
Thanks, Graham, and good morning, everyone. Now abideth faith, hope, love, these three. The greatest of these is love. So this is the essence of our calling as brothers and sisters of Christ, isn't it? Faith, hope and love. And this morning I want to focus on faith and what the basis of our faith is. So we could ask you, what is faith to you? And, I might ask what your definition of faith is, and you'd probably trot out Hebrews 11 verse 1, the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Well, what is faith to you personally? How do you know that you have it? How do you grow it? What does faith look like? In many of our minds, we might be thinking of the sort of, if we're thinking about Hebrews 11, those amazing acts of Hebrews 11, men and women who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. That might be what faith looks like in your mind. Acts of courage and bravery. David facing Goliath, Gideon facing the Midianites, Moses facing up to Pharaoh. And yes, these are all acts of courage motivated by faith. But they're not sort of everyday acts, are they? We aren't called on every day to front up to Pharaoh and say, let my people go. And yet we are required to develop faith every day. So I'm going to suggest a slightly different perspective on faith to you this morning, an idea that you may well have heard before. It's not my idea originally, but it's an idea I hope you'll think about if you haven't heard about it before. And the idea is this, that the foundation of faith is humility, and the enemy of faith is pride. When we're young, particularly, I think, we can be under the impression that we have to be all zealous about the truth, defending the doctrines or moral principles of the Bible. And there is a place for that from time to time. But zeal is not evidence of faith. And a combative attitude is, I think, evidence of probably a lack of faith. We're fighting battles for the sake of it. It may well be evidence of, instead of faith, it might be evidence of things like fear or of pride rather than of faith. Faith is really a complete reliance on God, isn't it? It's reliance on God rather than reliance on self. And if that's the case, then faith in your life and in my life is much more likely to be demonstrated through humility and gentleness, rather than in fighting out the perceived opponents of the truth, perhaps. David spent years as a humble shepherd before his 10-minute fight against Goliath. Moses spent 40 years as a humble shepherd before his, 1 month battle with Pharaoh. And if we're called to show faith every day, it's much more likely to be in the form of humility rather than fighting the battles of God. So that's our sort of axiom for this morning. The foundation of faith is humility. The undoing of faith is pride. Let's have a look and see if that is actually a biblical principle. Come with me. Let's start in the Old Testament, where all these principles are found, though less obviously than in the New Testament. We're going to start in Habakkuk. I'll give you several minutes to find that. Habakkuk chapter 2. Habakkuk chapter 2 and verse 4. Behold, his soul, which is lifted up, is not upright in him, but the just shall live by faith, by his faith. So the English word faith is only translated as such twice, at least in the King James Version, in the Old Testament. Only twice. It happens here once in Habakkuk 2 verse 4 and once in Deuteronomy 32 verse 20. Now, we've read the second half of this verse heaps of times because the just shall live by his faith is quoted three times in the New Testament, in Romans, in Galatians and in Hebrews. So it's one of the great, you know, it's probably the great foundation quotes for Paul's thesis that we are saved by faith. And we've always been saved by faith. Whether we lived under the law of Moses or in Abraham's time or after Christ lived and died and was resurrected. No matter when we lived, we are saved by faith. So three times New Testament writers use the second half of this verse to show that salvation is and always has been by faith. And yet, how many times have we read the first part of this verse? And you'll notice that the two halves of this verse really form a contrast, don't they? The first half, we've got this person with his soul lifted up, which is not upright. And then this is contrasted to those who live by faith who are just. And justification is the opposite of being, you know, not upright. So we have a choice. We can either be just or we can be not upright. And what determines this? Well, either we live by faith in the second half of the verse or in the first half of the verse, our soul is lifted up. And the ESV, the RV and the ASV all translate this phrase as, behold, his soul is puffed up. And the Hebrew word, appropriately, is pronounced awful, and it means to swell, to be elated. And even today, of course, we describe someone who with an inflated opinion of themselves, being full of pride, having a swollen head. That idea of being swollen is what the Hebrew word means. So here we have it in the Old Testament prophets. The contrast is pretty clear. Either we can be lifted up, swollen in pride, or we can live by faith. Either we live by self-reliance or we live in reliance of God. It's either faith or it's pride. The opposite of faith is pride. Pride is the undoing of faith. So the opposite, I think, of pride is humility. Humility is a really elusive characteristic, isn't it? If you think you've got it, you probably don't. If you have it, you probably won't know it. And it's really elusive because merely thinking that you do have it, of course, makes pride grow and humility diminish. And even talking about humility is difficult. I'm aware of the sort of the irony of me pontificating up here on the platform on the subject of humility. But the idea of humility is really found in the words of Jesus when he talks about the idea of smallness. So Jesus doesn't ever, as far as I know, say the words, you know, be humble or even sit down. He describes people instead in images. He describes people who are poor in spirit. He describes people who have the attitude of little children. He describes the basis of faith as a grain of mustard seed, which is the smallest of all the seeds in the earth. It's the attitude that he describes as being, as saying, I am an unprofitable servant. I'm insignificant. My needs are less important. My spirit is poor. My ego is small. So Jesus uses all these different images to describe humility. And when you think about it, it's logical that faith is based on humility, that the pride is the opposite of faith. A proud person is self-centered, self-confident, self-reliant. A humble person knows that they can't do it on their own. They know that they are completely reliant on God for everything, and reliance on God is faith. A humble person sees themselves as insignificant, powerless, which we know that we are, but sometimes we find it difficult to see. Without God, we are nothing, and so we rely on God, not ourselves, to do anything, to achieve anything. So even logic really teaches us that pride diminishes faith, but humility makes it grow. The rich young man was someone who had to learn humility. Come back to our record in Matthew. Matthew chapter 19, verse 14, Jesus says, "Suffer little children and forbid them not to come unto me, for of such is the kingdom of heaven." So just before this event with the young man, Jesus had been encouraging children to come to him. And what's the key characteristic of children? Well, flick back to Matthew chapter 18, just one chapter earlier, and we see it in Matthew chapter 18, verse 1. "At the same time, the disciples came unto Jesus, saying, 'Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?'" That was, you know, often the argument amongst the disciples. Who's the greatest? And Jesus, in verse 2, called a little child unto him and set him in the midst of them and said, "Verily I say unto you, except ye be converted and become as little children, ye shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven." Verse 4, "Whosoever therefore shall humble himself as this little child, the same is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." The disciples have been arguing about, you know, which of them was the greatest. What sort of motivates that argument? Of course, it's going to be pride. No doubt about that. And what was the antidote to that? What's the key characteristic of children that Christ wants us to learn? What did children have that the disciples were lacking? It's humility, isn't it? "Whosoever therefore shall humble himself as this little child." Humility is the key to discipleship. And humility doesn't want to make me the greatest, as we'll see later. It wants to make others the greatest. So the background to the rich young man is all about pride versus humility. So back to Matthew chapter 19 and verse 16. "Behold, one came and said unto him, 'Good master, what good thing shall I do that I may have eternal life?'" So you'll notice the emphasis on good here. Good master, what good thing should I do? Surely Christ would have been flattered to be called the good master. And yet Jesus stops him right there, doesn't he? "Why are you calling me good?" Now it seems almost a little unfair that Jesus picks him up on this. After all, there's no doubt that Jesus was good. He was sinless after all. He was a perfect man. You don't get sort of much gooder than that, do you? It's not that Christ was not good. In fact, he calls himself good. "I am the good shepherd," he says in John chapter 10, verse 11 and 14. And yet this goodness is the very thing that Christ questions, isn't it? "Why are you calling me good?" He questions the statement not because it's false, but because he wants to get at what is motivating this young man. Why does the young man call him good? I think it's because that's what he wants to hear Christ tell him that he is. It's like me, you know, greeting Brother Graham this morning by saying, "You're a fine-looking fellow," or, you know, "That's a great-looking shirt that you're wearing." The natural human desire is to hear something in return, isn't it? You know, as Graham would have said to me, "You're not too bad-looking yourself." So the young man calls Christ good because he wants Christ to say, "Good, you're the good one here. Keeping all those commandments from your youth up, that's outstanding." I think the praise of men is what this young man was after. And not just any man, he wanted Christ himself to exalt him in front of everyone. In fact, so confident was this young man that Mark 10 tells us that he came running up to Jesus. He's so confident, so self-confident, so proud in his own achievements that he ran up to Christ expecting to receive praise from him. And even the question he asked reveals that he was sort of anticipating a certain answer from Jesus. He knew the answer to his own question. As Jesus says in Mark 10 again, "Thou knowest the commandments." You know the answer to this question, Jesus says. It's sort of a Dorothy Dixer he was throwing up. He knew the answer to his own question, but he wanted to hear Jesus say it. He wanted Jesus to say, "What an amazing example of righteousness, of goodness we have here. You don't need me. You've worked it all out on your own." But Christ knows what's in man's heart, doesn't he? He doesn't even let this young man get away with what is essentially a true statement, "Good master," because he knows that it's motivated by this man's pride. Christ was good, but his goodness was due to the influence of his Father. And of course, despite his goodness, he was the most humble of all men, as we'll see a bit later. This man wants to be called good because of the good things he does. And that really was an example of his pride. In verse 18, the young man even asks, which commandments? What commandments do I have to keep? And again, he knew the answer. We can't pick and choose which of God's commandments we keep. He knew that. But he wanted Jesus to list off the commandments that he had to keep so that he could sort of, you know, tick them off in his own mind. No other gods before me? Yes, I've kept that one. No graven images? Yes, I've kept that one. Don't take the name of God in vain? Yes, I've kept that one. He knew them all. He kept them all. He knew he couldn't pick which ones to keep and which ones to reject. But again, in his pride, he wants Jesus to list them all off and acknowledge that he had kept them all. And in verse 20, here we've got the culmination of this young man's statement. All these things have I kept since I was a boy. Is there anything else I should be doing? Now, here's one question that he wasn't expecting an answer to, I think. I mean, what else could he do? He can't do more than keep all the commandments, surely. And at this point, I think Jesus was supposed to, you know, sort of give him what he had come for, some exaltation, some praise in front of everyone. This was really the point of the whole exercise, for Jesus to be amazed at this young man's goodness, and he was. But Jesus does have an answer for him, and it's a very sort of deflating answer for the young man. Instead of going away exalted, the young man goes away sorrowful. It wasn't this young man's wealth, per se, that was going to keep him out of the kingdom. It was his pride. His wealth and his pride were really just two sides of the same coin. His wealth made him self-reliant. He didn't need anyone else, did he, in this life? Just as his good works made him also self-reliant. He was going to save himself by doing good. He didn't really need God, did he? He had done all this good. Well, what God really wants from us and from this young man to be saved is faith. And faith is based on humility. He needed to get rid of his wealth and in faith rely entirely on God's providence. His wealth had become a source of his pride as much as his good works had. It had become a source of his status, his self-confidence. And there was no way that he could learn humility with it. And without humility, he'd never develop faith. And without faith, as we know, he could not be saved. In verse 19, Christ had told him that he had to love thy neighbour as thyself. And here we begin to see the key to humility as well. This young man certainly loved himself, but could he extend that same love to his neighbour? If he could, that would be true humility, but it would be difficult. And his wealth was really testament to how much he loved himself. Could he give that all away to his neighbours? Instead of being exalted by Christ for his goodness, the young man departs, as we know, in sorrow. What he thought was his greatest strength, his good works, was actually his greatest weakness. What he needed was not more wealth or more praise or more good works. To the contrary, these things needed to be replaced by humility and reliance on God. And Christ really provides the true answer to the question this young man should have been asking. So if pride is the enemy of faith, if humility is the basis of faith, the question becomes not necessarily how do we increase our faith, because we know the answer to that now. The answer is to make ourselves small. To develop our faith, we need to develop humility. The question then becomes, well, how do we develop humility? Again, that concept of humility is very tricky for us. We like to claim, especially in prayers, that you know we're humble, we're coming humbly before God. But in reality, no one likes to be humiliated, do they? We want humility, but we don't want humiliation. Humility is the basis of faith because it forces us to trust in God. And pride is the opposite of faith because it's all about self. Self-aggrandizement, self-indulgence, self-reliance, even self-control, which is a good characteristic, can be a source of pride. So what's the answer? How do we defeat pride, become more humble, and so build up our faith all at the same time? They're all sort of part of this one bundle, aren't they? If we can do one, then the other two will, I think, automatically happen. If we can become more humble, our pride will decrease and our faith will increase. So how do we do it? Well, Paul has an answer for us that we know, I think, pretty well in the book of Philippians. So let's have a look at Philippians. We could really look at the theme of humility in Philippians and warning. It's right through the book. But let's go straight to Philippians chapter 2. And this really gets right at the crux of the matter. So Philippians chapter 2 and verse 5. And you'll notice all the descriptions, all the synonyms for humility in this section. Philippians 2 verse 5. Let this mind be in you, which is also in Christ Jesus. So that's excellent. We want the mind that Christ had. Now that can sound like a very sort of esoteric thing. We want to have the mind of Christ. What exactly does that mean? Well, Paul spells it out for us. It doesn't leave us in any doubt exactly what aspect of Christ's mind he's talking about here. Verse 6. Who being in the form of God thought it not robbery, something to be grasped at, to be equal with God. But what's this mind that we want? Made himself of no reputation and took upon him the form of a servant, a doulos, a slave, and was made in the likeness of men. Not God or even of angels, he was made in the likeness of men. And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient, like a good slave, unto death, even the death of the cross. Wherefore God also hath highly exalted him and given him a name which is above every name. So Christ is our lead, isn't he, as in all things. His exaltation was based firstly on his humility. A man who had the power to do anything, to be anything, and yet he doesn't grasp at equality with God, does he? He's born in very ordinary circumstances and lived the life of a slave to other people. The challenge for Jesus was not to be the Messiah the people was expecting, wasn't it? But to be the Messiah that they needed. The people were expecting Messiah to be a mighty man, a great king for them. And the temptation for Jesus really is to not do that. He had the ability and the power to do that, to be all they expected in a Messiah. They're expecting a king, a man of boldness and of power and of leadership. And Jesus instead takes the form of a slave. That was the Messiah the people needed. That's the Messiah that we needed, an example for us to follow. He's the prime example of humility. Despite his potential power, despite his goodness, despite his righteousness, he was humble. And we face the same challenge now, don't we? We might expect ambassadors of Christ, men and women of faith, to look bold and powerful, charging in where others fear to tread. But what God really wants from us is humility, meekness, and easiness to be entreated. So what about us? How do we cultivate this attitude of humility and so increase our faith? Philippians 2 verse 3 and 4, let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem other better than themselves. Look not every man on his own things, but every man also on the things of others. Now we often say in prayer, as I said, we sort of come humbly before God. We approach him in humility, and hopefully that's true. Hopefully we do approach God with a humble attitude. Only a stupid person, logically speaking, would do otherwise, really. But that's not exactly a challenge, is it? Saying those words in a prayer is not really an act of humility. It's just an act of non-stupidity. If we can't approach the God who created the universe with a sense of humility, then we've got real issues. Saying that we come before God in humility is really just stating the facts, isn't it? The test of humility is not our attitude towards the God of heaven and earth, but our attitude towards our brothers and our sisters. The test of humility is not our attitude towards those who are greater than us, but our attitude towards those who are our equals or who we might perceive to be our inferiors. So here's our answer, really. Let each esteem other better than themselves. Now, if it's humility we're after, and that is what we're after, we really have two options in fulfilling this verse. The first option is that we can keep putting ourselves down, sort of berating ourselves, telling ourselves that we're worthless, and that would result in a humility of sorts, wouldn't it? A lack of self-esteem, a feeling of, you know, low self-worth. But that's not what Paul tells us to do, is it? He doesn't say, keep putting yourself down. What we need to do is, as Paul suggests we do, not put ourselves down, but lift everyone else up. So in verse 4, again, note that word also. We don't ignore our own welfare completely, but we also look out for the welfare of everyone else. So we can sort of achieve this humility in either a negative way or in a positive way. Paul says, do it in the positive way. Don't do it by depressing yourself, but by elevating all those around you. So how do we do that in a sort of practical sense? I think we do it by looking out for the best in others, by valuing their good characteristics, by valuing their strengths rather than, as our natural human tendency is, to focus on their weaknesses. Everyone is better than you in some area. Make a conscious effort to acknowledge, either verbally, directly to them, or just in your head, that area. Is it their cheerfulness? Is it their love? Is it their patience? Is it their capacity for forgiveness? Is it their evident, strength of faith? Even as the old hymn book puts it, the meanest saint has at least one area of strength. It might even be their humility. How do we know if we're humble? Well, verse 14 is a simple test. Philippians 2:14, do all things without murmurings and disputings. Do we do what we do without murmurings and disputings? Or do we do things begrudgingly? Do we attend meetings resenting those that we know haven't put in the effort to attend? Do we murmur at the very thought of doing hall cleaning, or more than our sort of share of hall cleaning? Are our business meetings without disputing? Do we begrudge the speaker who speaks too long, or the chairman who prays too long? A proud person is constantly finding faults in others. A humble person is always looking for the good in others. Finding fault will lead to murmuring and disputing, a begrudging spirit, in other words. Finding the good in others will lead to like-mindedness, being of one accord and of one mind. Back to verse 3. Let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, but in lowliness of mind let each esteem other better than themselves. So it's not just a matter of thinking that others are better than ourselves. The fact is, we have to be humble enough to realise that we actually need each other, that we won't make it without the assistance of even the lowliest member, as we might perceive it, of the ecclesia. We have to put aside our pride, our stubborn independence, and be prepared to accept help from those who we may, in a natural sense, see as our inferiors. So again, it's pretty easy to acknowledge that we won't make it through this life without God's assistance. That should be sort of pretty much a given. But it requires humility to acknowledge that we won't make it through life without the assistance of our brothers and sisters, and not just those who we think might be stronger than us, but others who we might have considered to be our inferiors in some way. And humility isn't something we can just turn on for ecclesial situations either, and then ignore in our secular lives. We can't approach God in humility and fail to treat our brothers and sisters with humility. And in the same way, we can't treat our brothers and sisters with humility, but treat other people with arrogance and contempt. If we're to be humble at all, we're to be humble at all times. And so in daily life, away from the ecclesia, we maintain a humble attitude and place our faith in God. And by that means, our humility and our faith in Him will grow. Humility at work or at school means that we might have to suffer ourselves to be defrauded. Humility may mean accepting blame for something that we didn't do wrong, or watching someone else get the praise for something that we did right. It might mean someone else getting the credit for that group project that we did most of the work for. It means treating everyone with respect, including those that we think might be our inferiors in any way, socially perhaps, economically, intellectually, physically, and even morally. So just because as Christadelphians we sort of know God's position on a moral issue, that doesn't give us the right to personally denigrate those who do not. Humility means not asserting our rights in the workplace or driving on the road. It means allowing others to be served in front of us. It means not responding with aggression when confronted, whether we're right or wrong. It means we may lose out financially, perhaps, because we don't insist on our rights or enforce an agreement. Humility means going against our pride and asking for help when we need. It means acknowledging that we don't always have the correct answer. It's the ability to say, sorry, I was wrong. Humble is what we need to be always, not just in the presence of God's awesomeness, not just in his ecclesia, but everywhere and always. Humility is the key to faith, and the basis of faith is humility. If we can develop humility, we can defeat pride, and if we can do that, our reliance on ourselves will diminish, and our reliance on God will grow. Our faith will develop, and Christ will recognise himself in us when he returns. Final thought from Peter, 1 Peter 5, verse 5 and 6. Likewise, ye younger, submit yourselves unto the elder. Yea, all of you, be subject one to another, and be clothed with humility. For God resisteth the proud, and giveth grace to the humble. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time.